This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this U.S. politics edition of the program, will the United States witness the first indictment of a former president? Former President Donald Trump, the subject of at least four government investigations, predicted he would be, quote, arrested on Tuesday, March 21, an event which did not occur. However, the news media has been speculating for more than 1 week that a New York grand jury and Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg would indict Donald Trump for hiding payments that were hush money to silence adult film actress Stormy Daniels about an alleged affair with Trump. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Newsflash, as of Friday, March 24, Trump has not been indicted, but he is certainly not out of the woods. Per NewsHour correspondent Lisa Desjardins, the other cases include a civil lawsuit in New York State alleging the Trump Organization lied to lenders and insurers about its assets. The state of Georgia is considering charges surrounding efforts by Trump and his allies to overturn the 2020 election there. And on the national level, the Department of Justice has appointed a special counsel to investigate two wide-ranging areas, the classified documents found at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida and efforts to interfere with the 2020 election, which culminated with the January 6, 2021 insurrection on the Capitol. So how do these probes, any of which could result in an indictment, affect candidate Trump as he continues his quest to clinch the Republican nomination for president in 2024? How do Trump's legal woes factor into Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' calculations as he gears up to challenge Trump in the Republican primaries? And how is the Republican-controlled House of Representatives reacting to the legal cases swirling around former President Trump? A letter sent by House Republicans to Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg saying that a move to charge Trump would represent an unprecedented abuse of prosecutorial authority indicates their pro-Trump bias. Meantime, if a bipartisan agreement is not reached in the coming months to raise the debt ceiling, the country faces the prospect of a first-ever default by this summer. House Republicans still have not agreed on a plan that would get all 218 of them to vote for a debt ceiling increase. For more on the U.S. political landscape, we turn to our regular duo, John Fortier, who is political scientist and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank here in Washington, and Jim Kessler. He is executive vice president for policy at Third Way, and that's a center-left policy group also based in Washington. And as always, they join me via Microsoft Teams. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Carol.
So let's begin with you, John Fortier, the so-called Trump indictment. People have been on what we call indictment watch now for the past week. Well, despite no concrete action on these impending cases, what is your assessment of them? And how do you think they will affect Trump's candidacy and the Republican primary?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that we return to business as usual for much of the Trump presidency, and that there's controversy and we're focusing on Donald Trump. And I think both for Donald Trump and for the media, they're sort of enjoying that. In this case, we have a number of potential cases that could be brought against Donald Trump. This one, arguably, I think, is one of the weaker ones, both in terms of the legal case and the subject matter. And so Donald Trump could face some problems here, but I think there was really a pushback on his part, certainly, but also in many Republican circles, that is this a political prosecution? And again, this is a state prosecutor elected who's looking at a set of facts that's been around for a while that other people had not chose to prosecute. And you know, this, I think, has helped Donald Trump, him in the short term. I don't think we know about the long term, but in terms of the immediate effect, there's been a bit of a rally around the president phenomenon, certainly of his supporters, but even a broader group of Republicans saying they're with the president and they think that this might be a political prosecution. The governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis. At this point, Ron DeSantis is the clearer alternative to Donald Trump. It's not absolutely clear he can beat Donald Trump, but it looks like there are two big candidates in the race. And Ron DeSantis has done a lot to cultivate cultivate that. You know, I think in the short term, he's put in a tricky position. There was a question of whether he was strongly enough condemning this potential indictment, whether he was throwing Donald Trump out there a bit by criticizing him indirectly by the fact that he was paying money to Stormy Daniels. And it does highlight the difficulty that he will face on the campaign trail. In some ways, he really does want to be able to appeal to Trump voters and has a record that might be able to do that. On the other hand, he's going to have to engage him more directly. And Donald Trump himself is going to hit back hard, as he did this week. I think that's all true, but I guess I would stress that this is a short-term effect. We don't really know whether in a month that this is going to continue. And it is an issue that Ron DeSantis would have had to face anyway, going down the road. So I think in the short term, good for Donald Trump, perhaps a small problem for Ron DeSantis. But down the road, we'll just have to see if these are lasting effects or something we're talking about in the time of this indictment, and maybe not so much in a month or two.
Turning to you, Jim Kessler, of course, John Fortier was primarily talking about the Stormy Daniels, the hush payment. But on the other hand, there are several other very serious cases which seem to be heating up. The classified documents case at his Florida estate, Mar-a-Lago, his efforts to interfere with the 2020 election, the special counsel. So let me get your take on the state of play, how it affects Trump and his prospects.
Well, I agree with John that the Stormy Daniels case, the one that the Manhattan district attorney is taking up, is probably the weakest case, but it's the only case that involves sex in the media. And therefore, it's the most interesting case for the American people. I mean, I just think it's going to keep people's interest. And from the Democratic point of view, I mean, Democrats are divided about whether this is good for Democrats or bad for Democrats, and good for Trump or bad for Trump. And, you know, I'm kind of falling into the category that I think this is better for Trump. You know, it puts him into the victim category. And I don't think there's going to be conviction in this case, but we'll see. The vulnerabilities are, I think, twofold. On the legal side, we'll start hearing more things about this case that either reminds us of what happened or tells us something new about what happened in this case, because there's hush money that was paid to Stormy Daniels. But also part of this is the media essentially buying the story and killing the story. And that's part of this as well. The other thing that I find interesting and somewhat baffling is how the Republican candidates who are either already taking on Trump or expected to take on Trump for the 2024 nomination are really tiptoeing around this, when instead they should be far more aggressive. I know there are a lot of Trump supporters and Republicans who think this is prosecutorial overreach, and you can pay some lip service to that. But you can also say, look, this is a guy who had an extramarital affair, a tryst while his wife was nursing a new baby, got caught, paid hush money. That's illegal. You know, you reap what you sow. And when you're running against Donald Trump, you can't play patty cake with him. You've got to go after him with everything you've got. And I think the Republican presidential candidates and wannabes are handling this too gingerly. They need to use it to their advantage.
Well, picking up on that, John Fortier, I guess that raises a couple of questions. Is the Republican Party still in the thrall of Trump, notwithstanding Ron DeSantis pretty much gaining some interest? Nonetheless, they seem to be rallying around Trump, not just with the Stormy Daniels case, but these other national level cases, whether it's the classified documents, which is far more serious, one could argue, and also trying to overturn the election in Georgia and also the national election. Are they still just behind Trump? And that's why they are not going after him, as Jim Kessler says they should.
Donald Trump is still a very popular and important figure in the Republican Party and has a good chance of being the nominee for the Republican Party. What he also has in Ron DeSantis is a potential strong contender that he might not have had, with maybe a divided field, where Donald Trump, even if he didn't have a majority, would be able to go through. And so I think that's the dynamic that he's facing now. And when Ron DeSantis is potentially able to appeal to some of the voters who would be with Trump, but maybe have some reservations about his character or that he could win, or the sort of circus that sometimes surrounds him, but still would be kind of in the Trump camp broadly in terms of policy or attitude. When something like this comes around, I do think there is a pretty broad swath of the Republican Party that says, look, this is not the Biden administration. This is a New York prosecutor. But there are some cases where, in the federal case, well, maybe it's the other side is putting this case forward politically. That is naturally going to have you rally around your president. And so I think there's still some support there, but maybe some doubt because of Ron DeSantis in the race or whether Trump can consolidate all this. And yet this type of incident is going to give Donald Trump a boost. Ron DeSantis himself, as I mentioned before, I think, you know, he has a tricky job, but in a way, he's the only one of the challengers who has this problem, which is a good thing because he's a potential good candidate, is that he has to, in some ways, appeal to Trump voters and at the same time, distinguish himself from Donald Trump. I'm not sure that Jim's theory of going really hard at Donald Trump at this point is the right thing, but he had to try to walk that line and it didn't go perfectly well for him this week. But again, he's going to have to do that over and over again in the debates and other ways where he in some ways criticizes Donald Trump and in other ways says he's part of that legacy and can get some of those voters.
He certainly is in that lane, isn't he, Jim Kessler? I mean, Ron DeSantis, he's like a Trump light. He's on the cultural wars. Even on until recently, he flip-flopped on the U.S. involvement in Ukraine, saying that this was some sort of a territorial dispute, which is, you know, absurd. I think, you know, most Republicans, traditional Republicans, even though there's a faction that defends that argument, that he walked that back, saying that Putin is, in fact, a war criminal. So that's on the international front. But people talk about what is the Republican Party, even with Ron DeSantis, he's still in the Trump camp, even though he's trying, of course, to replace Trump. Then there's the argument, of course, on the Democratic side that, you know, no one is above the law. I mean, that should also be a Republican refrain. No one is above the law, even an ex-president, if indicted and convicted. What are your thoughts with regard to if Trump is, in fact, indicted? Can he even still run? What are the impediments and so forth?
I think an indictment like this, he certainly can still run. You know, look, Ron DeSantis is selling himself as the Trump policies and the Trump position on, you know, the culture wars without the Trump drama. You know, I'm a bit of a DeSantis skeptic. I think he's stumbling around trying to find out where to be on a lot of issues. You mentioned the flip-flop on Ukraine. That's really inexcusable at this point in the war and in the debate. And look, I do believe that the culture wars that he's fighting work in a Republican primary. I don't think it works in a general election, but I think it works in a Republican primary. And you don't get to the general election unless you can win the Republican primary. The problem that Republicans have is the people who have taken on Trump in the last 5-6 years have all lost. And they've either lost to Trump or they've lost their jobs, you know, in other ways. Lost re-election like Liz Cheney, were defeated in leadership posts, lost primaries. So, you know, we like to think that our politicians are leaders. Most of them are followers. And the Republican Party right now, you hear privately from Republicans, Republican staffers, Republican elected officials in Congress, a lot of them, they despise Trump. They quietly like pat Democrats on the back for going after him, but they don't want to stick their neck out. And to defeat him, people are going to have to stick their neck out. You're not going to out-polite, out-policy position your way to defeating Trump. You have to go after him, you know, like an ultimate fighting championship bout where you're just going to go after him, no holds barred with everything that you've got. And I don't see Republicans willing to do that. And they're missing an opportunity here with the Stormy Daniels situation, which, again, you can say overreach by the prosecutors, but cheating on his wife with a porn star, paying hush money, that's wrong, that's bad, that's immoral, let's get rid of this drama.
And it's also potentially a campaign finance violation and lots of accounting tricks that are considered unlawful. But we'll have to take a quick break and we'll continue our conversation about other issues on the political landscape. You are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests are John Fortier, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and Jim Kessler, from whom you just heard. He's executive vice president for policy at Third Way. And we are discussing the many investigations of former President Donald Trump and other issues dominating the political landscape. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on most of your favorite podcast apps. You may also download the show from the webpage at voaafrica.com/encounter. You may follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Ulana Nigatu Ebisa from Ethiopia. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to you, John Fortier. Let's get to some other issues. And of course, mentioning social media platforms. TikTok comes to mind. We just witnessed a hearing on TikTok and its potential, you know, conflicts with the Communist Party in China, even though the TikTok manager tried to push back on that. What about that particular hearing and other hearings? What is going on, the normal political business in terms of the House of Representatives, the Republican-controlled House? How are things going in that vein?
On the TikTok vein, and I think I've said this in some other areas, there were some interesting issues with that hearing. I think some generational issues, younger and older voters may be taking it differently. But as for the members of Congress and the positions of the political parties, TikTok, of course, is related to the China issue, which both parties in maybe slightly different ways have found their way to be very critical of China. And that's a development that has come in the last 7 or 8 years or so, an evolution there. So in the case of, you know, generally speaking, the policy towards China, it's not good to be on the side of the Chinese or investment. Again, maybe the children or the grandchildren of the people at the hearing are going to raise a cry that they need TikTok. It's very popular, of course, with younger people and younger voters. But I do think, generally speaking, this is the one area where Republicans and Democrats actually are working together in a sense in the China policy. And so if you want to take that as comfort that there are some areas on Capitol Hill that have some bipartisanship, I think that's a good thing. Generally speaking, otherwise, look, I think not that there isn't anything else going on, but we are looking ahead to the debt ceiling and then ultimately to the budget process. And that's really where the rubber is going to hit the road in divided government. There are many smaller things that perhaps a Congress with Republicans in charge of one body and Democrats in charge of the other body can do. But in terms of the big things that they're going to have conflict over, we're going to have to deal with. We're waiting for the debt ceiling this summer and appropriations and sort of final budget and, you know, probably in the fall.
Indeed. So back to you, Jim Kessler. No question. It's nice that there's some consensus on TikTok, et cetera, and other social media platforms that should be regulated in the view of many Democrats and Republicans. But as John Fortier said, the rubber is going to hit the road very soon on the debt ceiling and the budget process. How optimistic are you that some kind of a consensus can be reached on these debt ceiling negotiations? And remind us of what's at stake.
I put myself in the optimist camp on this, realizing that it's going to appear teetering and that it's going to collapse and we're going to breach the debt ceiling and default all the way up to the point where we cut a deal. Like, this is going to be a high drama, high stakes poker game that, you know, will have a lot of the financial world riveted, because if the United States defaults on its debt, especially when you're looking at the situation we're seeing already with the banking crisis that's brewing in the last couple of weeks, like, this could really be damaging, not just for the U.S. economy, but the world economy. If you look at the state of the negotiations right now, during the State of the Union, the president basically got Republicans to stand down on Social Security and Medicare. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, said defense is not going to be touched. There are certain things that just simply can't be touched in the budget, like federal pensions and veterans pensions and interest payments on the debt. So if you take all of those things and say, okay, we're not going to touch those things, that's 65% of what the government spends. So the remaining negotiations are on the 35% that's left. And, you know, you can make a lot of promises of what you're going to cut there, but it's not easy to get a ton of spending cuts out of those programs. And what Republicans are going to be aiming at mostly is the part of the budget known as domestic discretionary spending. And that is all the money that is appropriated for domestic programs like housing and environmental cleanup and education, a lot of things that Democrats like. But it also includes a lot of things that Republicans like: border security, FBI, Secret Service, U.S. Marshal Services, and then a lot of other things that everyone likes: railway safety, highway safety, food safety. So in the end, I think this deal is going to be cut mostly with Biden, Schumer, and Mitch McConnell. Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House and a Republican, I think he's the weakest of the four at the table, and he'll probably have to take the deal that those other folks reach. That will include some cuts that he can sell to his caucus, but I just think that the other three are more the power players at the table.
So, John Fortier, this is Jim Kessler's theory. We've heard it before, and it's interesting that he sticks by it, that a decision on raising the debt ceiling will be cut. by President Biden, with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, you know, just sort of having to grin and bear it and accept that. Where do you come down on that? And also, we need to remind our listeners that this debt ceiling raise, you know, is something very unique to the United States. Basically, these are bills that we've already incurred. In other words, it's not like new spending. So you might want to underscore that. And what is your sense of where this is going to end? Will it, as Jim said, do you think it will, at the last minute, a deal will be struck? And there's a lot of posturing by House Republicans to, but in the end, they don't really have a proposal of where cuts can be made for future spending.
Well, if Jim is going to describe himself as an optimist, I'm with him on this, because I think he's right in the sense of the final outcome we expect. And look, this is not a new thing. We have had debt ceiling crises before, and we have gone up to the end of the day, and we have ultimately resolved them. And the simple point is, we are ultimately going to have to raise the debt ceiling. But the question is, how? And it will be messy, and it will be towards the end. And I agree with Jim on the limited pool of resources that one could put towards spending cuts if this were part of the deal. So I think that's all true. I mean, the only small quibble I have is, in some ways, Kevin McCarthy is important in the sense that the House of Representatives, of course, is in Republican hands. And that means that at least some Republicans will need to vote for this. Now, not necessarily very many. And that could come out in a way where some Republicans decide to vote present or grudgingly accept some deal. But ultimately, there's going to have to be some buy-in for the House of Representatives to pass this by some Republicans. And so I think Kevin McCarthy is going to be a little bit more part of the process. And I guess I also think, generally speaking, we'll probably have some more of a mechanism. We may have some specific cuts we're talking about, but we may just have a mechanism. And you know, people can make fun of those mechanisms because none of them in the past have ever worked perfectly, although some of them have worked to a degree or for a while. And I think that's the kind of thing we're going to be crafting, some sort of mechanism which will make it harder to raise spending over time or to try to bring the deficit down by a certain amount over time in a certain way. So again, I think we'll resolve this. I think the same thing will happen with the budget appropriations process. We may go past deadlines and have continuing resolutions. Ultimately, we will fund the government. We may have a shutdown, but it will be short. And so these are not new things. We've had Joe Biden, Barack Obama in the Senate voting against debt ceiling raises. We've had Republicans voting against them. We've had these crises. And so I don't want to alarm people to think this is really going to go to the last step. I think that's the way to be optimistic. But it will be very messy. And the limited nature of the cuts, I think, is something that I agree with Jim on.
Democrats and Republicans have voted against it, but at the end of the day, they knew that the votes were there, probably to raise the debt ceiling. But let's close, and let me start with you once again, John. We'll be on the indictment watch in the coming weeks, whether it's the Stormy Daniels hush money or what some may characterize as the more serious cases. But what about the Democrats? How's Joe Biden doing, John Fortier? Do you think, you know, he's still in the running to be the Democratic nominee? What do you say?
Joe Biden is strong within his party. Since the summer of last year, he really has strengthened his position in the party. And the idea that somebody will challenge him or that he can't have the nomination if he runs is really off the table. So he's strengthened himself within the party. Look, he is still a president who is not particularly popular and has numbers in terms of his job approval rating, which at least where they are now, wouldn't point necessarily to re-election, might point to a close race, but aren't particularly good. And then, of course, the other thing that we all should not underestimate is the big factors that underlie election aside from the candidates. I don't know what the economy is going to look like in a year. Is it going to be worse? Are we going to have a recession? Obviously, a recession would be very bad for Joe Biden and Donald Trump and other things. Don't change the fundamental rules of politics that much. On the other hand, a bounce of some sort and clear, good economic news would make Joe Biden very hard to beat.
Okay, Jim Kessler, you get the last word.
If we had this discussion 2 weeks ago, I think the feeling was like Joe Biden's in really good shape, not just within his party, but, you know, nationally. And then we had the collapse of the Silicon Valley Bank and what may or may not be a banking crisis in America and worldwide. And the feeling now that, gee, we might have this recession that people are warning about. So a lot will depend on what the economy looks like over the next several months and really the next year about how strong Biden is. The other piece is, who do Republicans nominate? Biden famously says all the time, don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative. If the alternative is Donald Trump, I think Joe Biden looks pretty good. If it's DeSantis, I also think he looks pretty good. John Fortier is right. He doesn't have the approval numbers that you would like to see if you're a Democrat seeking re-election. But then when there's an alternative out there, Biden can look a lot better.
All right, gentlemen, on that relatively optimistic note, at least for the Democrats, that is all the time we have on this politics edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, John Fortier, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and Jim Kessler, executive vice president for policy at Third Way. As always, a terrific and lively discussion. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Do join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.